For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio, usually recorded from the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm Red Sale, talking to you from my broom cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, talking to you from the bedroom. And coming up on this week's show,
we investigate a suspicious death from Tudor times with historical novelist Nicola Cornick.
We've got more Cabin Fever fables from Saraband Books, this time with author, cookery writer and winner of MasterChef Sue Lawrence.
Romantic novelist Bella Osborne urges us to meet her at Pebble Beach.
We've got some good news from RNIB about the reopening of the Braille Library.
And this week, Books of Your Life comes from Sir Salman Rushdie.
That's all coming up in today's Read On.
Nicola Cornick's time slip novels are a compelling blend of history and mystery. In her latest book, The Forgotten Sister, she takes us back to the court of Queen Elizabeth in 1560 and an unexplained death, while at the same time following the fall from grace of a 21st century celebrity.
Everyone was drunk. They had broken into the wedding favour boxes early and were downing champagne directly from the quarter bottles, lobbing chocolates at each other and throwing the beribboned scented tea bags into the swimming pool. Amelia, the bride, who had personally chosen the rose puchon and green jasmine tea bags to match the scented candles, had stormed off in tears. Dudley, instead of going after his new wife, had jumped, fully clothed, into the pool, laughing maniacally. Lizzie thought boy bands were the pits, especially Dudley's band, Callback Summer, whom she secretly believed were just talentless, entitled rich boys. She would never say that to Dudley, of course. He was her friend. But she wrote and played her own music, and before they'd split up, her band had been way more successful than Dudley's. Lizzie didn't drink. She hated it when Dudley behaved like her father, ringing her up, slurring his words as he told her she was his best friend in the world, that he'd love her forever. It was only because they'd known each other since the age of 6 that she put up with it. She had no idea why he had married Amelia anyway, unless it was for publicity. He'd said he was in love, but Dudley was always falling in love with someone. It was a stupid idea to get married when you were only 18. Lizzie didn't intend to marry anyone, ever.
Kristin Atherton narrating The Forgotten Sister by my guest, Nicola Cornick. Nicola Cornick, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back again.
Well, it's wonderful to have another of your terrific time slip novels entering the RNIB library, particularly when everybody needs a bit of distraction. So for anybody who hasn't yet picked it up, could you tell us a little bit about the plot of The Forgotten Sister?
It's a dual time novel, so it's got two time strands. Again, I'm interweaving a story set in the present and a story this time set in the Elizabethan period. It's all about the love triangle, the relationship between Queen Elizabeth I, her royal favourite Robert Dudley, and Robert Dudley's rather inconvenient wife, Amy. I wanted to tell the story from Amy's point of view because so often Amy Robsart gets kind of overlooked because Robert Dudley and Elizabeth I, it's such a big love story and they were such huge, dazzling characters. I often think, well, you know, what about poor old Amy? She had a story to tell here as well. So in The Forgotten Sister, I kind of examine Amy's story in the Tudor period and Elizabeth's story in parallel in the present, which was really, really interesting because I have a character who is the modern day Elizabeth I, if you like. She's a celebrity, so she's got a lot of the characteristics that Queen Elizabeth I had. So I'm kind of drawing parallels between the two different eras. It was a lot of fun to explore. And of course, at the heart of it all is a big mystery as well, a historical mystery of what happened to Amy Robsart. We all know she fell down the stairs and broke her neck, but nobody knows whether it was an accident or whether it was Robert trying to get her out of the way so that he could marry the Queen.
Well, yes, as you say, it is one of the great enduring historical mysteries. You usually write about the Regency period, but is the Tudor period something that you've wanted to write about for a long time?
I've always had a soft spot for the Tudor period, but it was my first love probably as a reader. I very quickly became engrossed in the stories of Henry VIII's wives, and that led me on to lots of other books that I absolutely loved. So although I'd never written about it before I wrote The Phantom Tree, that was my first foray into Tudor history. It's always been a period I've been fascinated by, and I love tackling big historical mysteries, trying to come up with a solution. And my next book is actually about the princes in the Tower, so I'm tackling an even bigger historical mystery there. But it's great fun and such a fascinating time period to write about.
Were you a fan of the Josephine Tay novels when you were growing up? I'm thinking of The Daughter of Time.
Yes, that was one of my absolute first influences. I think my stepfather introduced me to that book when I was, I don't know, maybe about 11 or 12. And I remember him giving it to me and saying, I think you'll really enjoy this. And I've still got that copy, actually. It's a sort of really battered old book that was old even when he handed it over to me. So it's one of my treasures. Because I come from Yorkshire as well, and I was a strong Yorkist, that got me totally into the Richard III story. I did also read all of Josephine Tay's other books, I have to say, because I think she's a fantastic writer, a really wonderful mystery writer. But yes, The Daughter of Time is right up there on my favourite books of all time list.
Well, coming back to The Forgotten Sister, Robert Dudley really doesn't come out particularly well. He's a schemer.
That's a kind way of putting it, isn't it? Both the two Robert Dudley type characters in The Forgotten Sister, neither of them come out well. You probably gathered that as I was reading the history about Robert Dudley and Amy, I took him in quite a strong dislike, I think you could say. I mean, there are lots of good things that you can say about Robert Dudley. He was a great collector and a supporter of the arts and culture. I'm trying to be fair to him. He did have a lot of positive qualities, but I can't quite get past this theme about the fact that I feel that he was insanely ambitious and he sacrificed his first wife, Amy, to that ambition. I find that very hard to forgive. So yes, he comes out badly. And in the modern day, of course, the character called Dudley, who is based on him, is also a bit of a waste of space.
And Lizzie Kingdom, the modern day version of perhaps Queen Elizabeth, really does have quite a spectacular fall from grace, doesn't she?
She does, yes. I was very interested in examining the idea of celebrity and how quickly things can turn from being so successful and popular, and how public opinion can turn against you. And of course, these days, with the internet and social media, how everything just spirals out of control for Lizzie. And so that was quite an interesting thing to examine in the modern day story. And of course, a parallel to all the scandal and rumours that were circulating about Queen Elizabeth and Robert Dudley at the time, even before Amy died, everybody was gossiping about their relationship. So yes, I really enjoyed examining the parallels between the two stories there.
And that really did come through very strongly, how quickly one can fall from grace. And really, human nature has not changed in 550 years.
That's very true. That's a really good observation. The human interest in scandalous stories hasn't changed, I don't think. And yeah, absolutely. The way that you can have a spectacular rise and a spectacular success. I mean, you see this a lot, of course, in stories from the Tudor court all the way through the period, through, you know, Henry VIII. You could climb to great heights, but you could also fall an awfully long way. And I think one of the interesting things actually about Robert Dudley was that his grandfather had been executed by Henry VII, and then his father, he loses his head as well. Clearly didn't put him off, though, because he was equally as ambitious and prepared to take the risks in order to achieve the greatest heights he could. It's maybe not quite so final in the modern day, but I think, as we've seen, when there's public shaming and when celebrities put a foot wrong, you know, you go from being a hero to being an outcast so very fast. So it's a very interesting insight into how much things change and how much they stay the same, I think.
I wonder if in a couple of hundred years' time, people will be writing time slip novels about our time and the fall of our celebrities.
Funnily enough, I had thought about, and I've never written a time slip book that's kind of set in the present and the future, but that's a really interesting idea. And of course, yeah, in the future, who knows what people might be inspired by in the current time. It's a fascinating idea. It'd be rather fun to imagine yourself a couple of hundred years ahead of now, looking back on this period era, and what would people make of our society and its attitudes towards fame and celebrity, I wonder. Fascinating thought. I think you might have given me another book idea there.
Well, so long as you come back onto the show to talk about it in the future, we're quits.
Oh, thank you.
Again, the book has been recorded as a terrific and very compelling audiobook, this time by Kristin Atherton. It must be quite a relief that the audiobook and ebook versions are still reaching the audience, even if the paperback copies might not be quite so readily available.
Yes, I'm just so thrilled with the audiobook. I thought they did a brilliant, brilliant job on that. So I love the fact that that's out there. And I think listening to a book is, particularly in the last few weeks, I've really become much more able and interested in listening to books in that format, maybe because there's just more time sometimes to stop and give yourself the time to listen to an audiobook. But you get a different experience from them as well, I think. And being able to sit and just listen to somebody reading a book. I've snapped up quite a few audio books to listen to over the last few weeks. And the same with ebooks. I mean, it's wonderful that these are all available to people. I know my book buying habits have increased even more than usual in the current lockdown situation. So yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely that they're available, and I do hope people will be able to find them and enjoy them.
Apart from your own books, have you got a good recommendation that you've read recently that you could share with the listeners?
Yes, actually, I have. It's another time slip, I'm afraid. You can see what my interests are. But I have a colleague who writes time slip fiction who's called Christina Courtney. And she had a book out last month, which I now actually just got the paperback of that before they stopped delivering print copies. It's called Echoes of the Runes. Now, she is Swedish and she has a Viking background. So she's drawn on all of that Viking history to write a dual time story set in Sweden in the present and the, I think it's the 9th century. And it's just absolutely fascinating, both the historical parts of it, but just the way she conjures up the atmosphere of Sweden in the current time and the way she brings myths and legends into that. So yes, Echoes of the Runes by Christina Courtney is my big recommendation at the moment.
Fantastic. And are you finding much opportunity to promote The Forgotten Sister from home during lockdown?
I don't feel comfortable sort of being heavy on promotion at the moment. But at the same time, I know I've found a huge comfort in books and in reading and in listening to books as well, because they can take you away. And so just to escape for a little bit, it's wonderful. So I have been telling people on my social media that the book's coming out this week and it's available and so on. And also doing some events on Facebook and Zoom events where I can actually talk about the historical background and about writing historical fiction, which of course is always that I love talking about the research and the real background to my novels. So there have been plenty of opportunities for that, and I hope people are enjoying that sort of insight into the background. And I'm really enjoying being able to talk about it on programmes like this, so thank you very much.
Well, not at all. And of course, I suppose that most of your research now is up online too, so that a visit to the library isn't quite as necessary as it might have been 10 years ago.
Fortunately, there is an awful lot of stuff on the internet anyway, which is great. You still can't replace some of the visits to records offices. And of course, one of the things I do love doing is going around the actual sites where the stories have taken place, because that's such a great way to get a feel for the atmosphere. But having said that, of course, so many museums, galleries have created virtual tours at the moment, which I think is just amazing. So not only can you watch a virtual tour, but if that's not possible, they talk you through their different galleries. And I think people have found the most amazing ways to connect to make all these resources available. So that's absolutely great. I've been doing some fantastic virtual tours of various historical sites and castles and things.
And they are wonderfully descriptive. I did worry when I first started hearing about virtual tours of art galleries that they'd be showing me pictures and not describing them. But actually, I think people have learnt that audio description is a necessary part of any guided tour.
Yes, I've really noticed an increase in that. And it's all part of building up the vivid picture, because, of course, a part of it is in your mind and your imagination anyway. But again, I suppose a bit like listening to an audio book, they give you those ideas and then your mind takes that and makes something else of it. So the two things come together in a really positive way. I think I've been really impressed with some of the tours that I've been listening to.
Well, I need to get back to 1560 and find out whether Robert Dudley did push his wife down the stairs.
If only we knew for sure. Mind you, then it wouldn't be so much fun, would it? Because then there wouldn't be any mystery left.
Well, Nicola Cornick, thank you for reopening the case for me. And I will look forward to inviting you back onto the show. But in the meantime, stay safe. And thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and sending my very best wishes to everybody to keep safe and well.
The Forgotten Sister by Nicola Cornick is TB705402, and it joins a wide selection of Nicola's other books in the RNIB Library. For more information, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
We're here to help you stay connected during this coronavirus crisis, but many blind and partially sighted people are struggling and need urgent support at the moment. That means RNIB's helpline is now more needed than ever. So, if you're able to, would you consider donating to make sure every phone call is answered? Please text CONNECT to 70688 to donate £10 and make sure that RNIB can continue to support those who need us most. Thank you.
Saraban Books are an independent publisher in Scotland, and during this time of social distancing and self-isolation, they say that cabin fever is real. But Saraban don't want anyone to feel scared or alone, so they started a podcast. A place to share stories, spread calm, and have a laugh.
Hello, and welcome to Cabin Fever Fables. I'm Sarah Hunt from indie publisher Saraband, and this is episode 6. We're taking a little time each day on this podcast to focus on storytelling. We're challenging an author to read an extract from their work that is in some way relevant to an aspect of how the coronavirus is affecting us. It may be on health, cooking challenges, staying connected, or anything the author wants to relate to their experience. Today, we have a special guest, Sue Lawrence, who's just released a new historical thriller, which is based on a true event in Scottish history. Apart from writing historical fiction, Sue's other career is cooking. She's a former winner of MasterChef and a well-known food writer and broadcaster. You may have heard her on Radio 4's Kitchen Cabinet. We'll be coming back to the food later. The new book, The Unreliable Death of Lady Grange, is about Rachel Cheesley, wife of the Scottish Lord Justice Clerk, Lord Grange. In 1732, Lady Grange was abducted from her Edinburgh home and taken to a remote location on the Monarch Isles, west of the Outer Hebrides, and later to the even more remote St Kilda, to a barren, windswept, rocky island 40 miles out into the ocean. Lady Grange was thrust without warning into isolation, far away from her family and life as she knew it. Sounding familiar?
I stood on the beach, the cold water lapping at my bare feet, looking over the sea at the skerries and the glint of moonlight on the rocks. Even in the dark, this place had the capacity to look strikingly beautiful. I was taking my usual evening stroll over the sand, looking out to sea, hopeful, wishing. It was some 3 months since a boat had managed over to the Monarchs. There had been talk they'd be able to land again soon. I didn't hear this myself, of course. It was only Katrina who told me in our now well-established code of communication. I'd not ventured out in daylight for ages. I'd no wish for the company of others. Only Katrina was my loyal and faithful aide. Dear God, I'd even become used to her vile seabird broths and stews. But I did draw the line at fulmar eggs, those I could not stomach. I'd read most of the Shakespeare from Bella's trunk and was now becoming agitated as I'd nothing left to read.
We've already had a mention of food. It doesn't sound too appetising. And horrible to run out of reading material. But it will turn out that the misery hasn't peaked yet. It's only the beginning of the curve. We're going to pick up when Lady Grange has moved on to St. Kilda.
Even when I consider the hardship I have suffered over the past year and a half, it's nothing compared to the misery I must endure now. It is so much worse in every respect. I'm exceedingly weary of this godforsaken place with no one for company but a glaikit serving wench. Her bannocks make the memory of Katrina seem as if they were baked by a chef trained at the French court. The only sounds here, apart from the roaring of the wind and the crashing of the waves onto this barren rock, are the shrill squawks of guillemots and solan geese. I sit in this dark, windowless hovel that is now my new home and try to remember my fine life of old. The winter dragged on and on. The storm had lasted nearly a month, by which time most supplies had run out. My claret had finished long ago, but strangely, this hadn't affected me as much as it would have in the past. I seemed to have lost my great urge for it. God knows why. Perhaps the corks in my last box were tainted.
Thanks, Sue. I must say it puts a whole different light on the book, focusing on the lonely and dark windowless hovel and all the isolation. Thank goodness you mentioned the beautiful views, the moonlight and the seabirds. But let's turn to the four questions we're asking all our guests.
You're in isolation. You're at home. What are you reading to pass the time?
I find I have time to do quite a lot of reading at the moment. I'm still only halfway through Hilary Mantel's wonderful The Mirror and the Light, but enjoying that immensely. I'm just about to start Isabel Allende's new book, A Long Petal of the Sea, but have to immerse myself fully in that. But in between times, I'm rereading, for about the 100th time, Marcel Pagnol's Jean de Florette and Manon des Sources, two of my favourite books and certainly one of my favourite, all-time favourite films, with its wonderful, haunting melody.
Our second question is what you're going to be cooking tonight from your store cupboard. Bearing in mind you're a previous winner of MasterChef, I'm guessing you have one of those well-stocked larders we always read about in recipe books. Could you please stick with something we can all make with ingredients we might already have? I know your recipes don't usually involve special kit or techniques like sous vide or even blowtorches. We don't want anyone needing to go to A&E. Just give us a good, trusty recipe we can rely on to taste good even without your special talents.
What am I going to cook tonight from the larder? Well, I've always got tins of sardines in, and they're always sardines in olive oil. So I'm going to open the cans, tip out the olive oil into a big frying pan, let that heat up a little while starting to cook the spaghetti. Then I'm going to throw in a handful of fresh breadcrumbs, either white or brown, whatever, into the sardine-flavoured olive oil. Toast them away nicely, making sure they don't burn. And you can add in some garlic, always chilli. If you don't have fresh, use a chilli grinder. And then at the last minute, loads and loads of lemon zest. And then the sardines, throw them into the breadcrumb mixture. Drain the pasta, retaining about a cupful of the cooking water, and then mix everything together, the spaghetti and the sardine-y, chilli-ish breadcrumbs. It's delicious. It's based on a Sicilian spaghetti recipe. It's not authentic, but oh boy, it tastes good, and it takes no more than 10 minutes.
That's brilliant. Thank you. That's definitely transformed the standard of our recipes so far.
Who would you choose to dine with tonight if we were not all self-isolating?
Who would would I want to dine with? Well, I think Mary Queen of Scots, for starters. She was a fascinating character. I've always been so interested in her incredible life. And as a nice sparring partner, I thought John Knox as well. Get the two of them together. Well, it wouldn't be a dull dinner party, would it? Then I'd like some beautiful music, as well as obviously lovely food. And so I'd invite Felix Mendelssohn. And if I fed him really well, perhaps he'd sit down at my piano and play my all-time favourite piece by him, which is Rondo Capriccioso. It's lively and fabulous and goes on and on and on. It's wonderful. And then finally, I'd ask Madame Lily Bollinger, because she presumably would bring some champagne, and I think we'd have a rather jolly dinner.
What's the most idiotic or funny or noteworthy bit of corona advice or official tip or corona behaviour that you've seen today?
The most ridiculous rumour flying about, to my mind, was that eating ice cream should be avoided if you wanted to also avoid the coronavirus. Thankfully, completely untrue, one of these hoaxes and scams that's going around, because I will continue to eat lots of ice cream. It's good for you.
I'm loving the vibe here, with lots of ice cream and champagne and delicious Sicilian food to cheer us up. Speaking of Sicily, did you see the video of the Sicilian twins who were playing Coldplay's Viva La Vida on their violins at home? It's unmissable. Having Sue as our guest today means that we're thinking about food and cooking. We've been seeing some alarming news about how badly the food chain has been disrupted by this virus. For now, apparently there is plenty of food, but there are real problems with logistics, drivers, deliveries. And of course, large numbers of people can't get out at all to do any food shopping. And most delivery services are overwhelmed and still not accepting new customers. There are worries about who's going to harvest the crops and pick the fruit as the agriculture season progresses. And with more and more people suffering financial hardship, there are also more and more people relying on food banks, while those food banks are struggling to get donations. This is a time for everyone to pull together and make sure every single person has enough to eat. We'll be putting a few facts and ideas together for our next Cabin Fever Fables bulletin. In the meantime, that's all for today's episode. Thanks again to Sue Lawrence for inspiring us with the sardine dish and all the other things you've been talking about. If you want to join in with your stories or comments, you'll find us on Twitter, at Saraband Books.
Thanks very much to Sarah at Saraband Books. Their web address is saraband.net. That's S-A-R-A-B-A-N-D. And they're on Twitter at Saraband Books.
With its ability to wash away traces of the past and mould physical and emotional landscapes, the sea has always held a special fascination for writers. This potential for change lies at the heart of Bella Osborne's new novel, Meet Me at Pebble Beach, which has just entered the RNIB Talking Books Library. Bella, welcome to Read On.
Good morning, Red. Thank you for having me.
So, for those who won't have read the book yet, can you set the scene?
The story focuses on Regan, who has a friend who has a very glamorous lifestyle, which is the opposite of Paul Regan. She's in a dead-end job and just sort of trolling along. It's set in Brighton. She works in insurance in Brighton, which isn't very exciting. She buys a lottery ticket and she sits in a meeting, very bored, and starts writing her list of what she'd do if she won. And she's got this relationship with a colleague where they prank each other. And anyway, she locks her lottery ticket in her desk drawer, goes away for the weekend, comes back, and he's jumping up and down and says, check your numbers, I think you've won. And she checks her numbers, and sure enough, her numbers match the £10 million lottery win. So she's over the moon, so she dumps her useless boyfriend, she tells her boss where he can stick his little job, and she walks out. At that point, her colleague says, it was just a joke. It's a prank, you've not won the lottery at all. So I guess it's about we're all just a few bad decisions away from being homeless. And this is where she finds herself. She's got nothing and nobody. And the story is about her trying to pull herself back together and using the wish list that she wrote before she won the lottery as to what she'd do. Can she do any of those things without the money? And that's it in a nutshell, without giving too much away.
Gosh, well, hopefully the prank allows her to free herself from what has become routine. And having read your other books, I know that there'll be romance, comedy, and hopefully a happy ending.
And we have to read it and see. I guess mine are sort of romantic comedy with a bit of a kick, or like rom-com drama. There's usually some sort of underlying menace going on. And in this case, there's various themes, but homelessness is a theme that runs through it.
And as the title would suggest, it's set by the seaside, presumably in Brighton.
It is, yes. I love Brighton. I think it's real sort of quintessential British seaside town. Everything a British seaside town should be, really. So it provides a nice backdrop, and something that was already in the story, but I've since learnt as I've done more research with Brighton, is that actually there's a really nice community feel. And the open market especially has been really supportive to me and answered loads of my silly questions. And there's a really lovely group of people there that do support each other, pretty much how I've pictured it in the book. So it's really nice that reality is the same as the story in that case. So it's a really nice, tight community, as well as being a very pretty seaside town.
And it has a rich tradition of stories being set there as well.
It does indeed. I can't claim to be up there with the greats, but yes, it obviously inspires a lot of people. It is a beautiful setting. I mean, there's something about, for me, the West Pier, which, if people haven't been or don't know, you've got the standard Brighton Pier, which I believe is called Palace Pier, which is beautiful and the only pier that remains. But at one time, they had two piers and the other was called the West Pier. And over the years, I mean, it went into disrepair, it was closed, and then it suffered storm damage and was set on fire at one point. So now there's this very strange, eerie skeleton, this charred remains, this outline of, I guess, the main part of the pier, or what would have been a theatre or something on there. And it just sits there. It's quite evocative. And when I go, I always end up sitting and looking at the West Pier. It's a beautiful setting. And that appears in the book as well. There's just something eerily fascinating about it. It's quite beautiful in its starkness, if that makes sense.
Do you think that's part of the enduring appeal of seaside settings, that things change there? Nothing is permanent.
Oh, interesting. It could be. I think there's also something that we like to go back to our youth, don't we? And the seaside, I think, reminds us of our youth, because it's always somewhere, I guess, desperate parents took children to while away the hours. Off we go, let's go to the beach. You can swim, you can dig things. And maybe that's it. Maybe we hold it in our hearts as being happy memories of the seaside. I certainly do. And I think of seaside times very warmly as very much family times and bringing people together. So maybe that's it. I don't know.
And of course, during lockdown, we would all love to escape to the seaside or to a lovely rural setting.
Anywhere, Red.
And it's wonderful to be able to do that in the pages of a book.
It is. Yeah, I'm finding that myself. I'm a big reader, and it's really lovely to pick up a book and just be transported somewhere. Some authors do it incredibly well, and obviously location is really strong in a lot of books that are set in various fantastic locations around the world. And it does make you feel like you've been away, or certainly been out of the house, which is a nice feeling at the moment.
Now, the book was first serialised, I believe, in four parts, and yes, this pulls those four parts together and publishes it for the first time as a novel. Do you enjoy writing as a serial?
I've got used to it. Do I enjoy it? That's a good question. It's a really good structure to work to, and I'm a project manager by trade, so I like structure and I like planning and I love plotting things out. So that probably does appeal to my strengths and my strange quirkiness for wanting to plan everything out on post-it notes. Yes, I guess I do. It's something I'll always use as a structure, whether I move away from releasing it in parts or not. It was something that suggested to me by my publishers originally, and the first one that we did was Willow Cottage, that went out in parts. And the idea was that it's a soft launch, if you like, and people that want to read it earlier can get it in the four parts digitally, and then it comes out as a whole book. So it is just one book split into four parts, but I have to think about that when I'm writing it, so that each part ends on something substantial, some sort of cliffhanger, some sort of question that obviously makes people want to read on. But you want that in the whole book anyway, because you want people at the end of the chapter to go, "Oh, what happens next? I need to turn the page." So it's a structure that works whether it's a whole book or whether it's in parts. But it's an interesting question. I think actually I probably do like working like that because I like structure.
Do you ever get tempted to go back and tinker with the first and second part when you've finished the fourth?
Oh, I have to. Because of the way we do it, it goes out in the four parts. So each part needs to be fairly evenly weighted. So I write overall to about 100,000 words. So each part needs to be about 25,000. And I think it was this one that when I finished it, I was about 100,000. I thought, oh, that's brilliant. But then when I looked, I was like way over in one, way over in three. Part four was about right. And part two was 15,000 or something. I was like, oh no. So overall, well, it was fine. But in the parts, it was all over the shop. So I had to do a lot of editing to get that balanced so that it was right. So that does take a bit of work in editing to make sure that you've got the right amount of words and therefore pages when people download it in the parts. Whereas if it was just one book, it doesn't really matter how that's split.
So the whole book is written before publication. You're not writing part four when part two is being published.
Oh, no. It tickles me when you see people sort of saying, oh, hurry up and write the rest. It's like, I wrote it like a year ago. I'm a floor planner and a project manager, so I'm well ahead. So no, it's all written together as one and it's edited as one, but paying attention to the fact that obviously it's going to be split into the four parts. So we're very conscious of that. But yes, it was all done, finalised and proofread September last year.
And another thing that's finished is the audiobook version, which will be joining three of your other novels in the RNIB library. Do you have much to do with the selection of the narrators?
I have in the past, not so much recently, and I've had choices of who I thought fitted the book best. But then, to be honest, the last one, they sent me a sample of her work and said, we think this is a good fit, what do you think? And yes, I thought it was. So that's kind of my level of involvement. I just get very excited that it is going to audio, because that's always a plus.
And you're reaching a whole audience who might otherwise be print disabled.
Absolutely. And audio is loved by so many, and it's definitely coming up. And whilst it's being really useful to people that can't use other forms of reading, it's just very popular in its own right now as well. So lots of people seem to prefer audio. Lead busy lives, so people have it on while they're doing the cooking or while they're driving and various other things. So it's a big thing now.
Regan knew it was going to be a bad day when she awoke to find she was using a half-eaten kebab as a pillow. You're going to be late again, said Jarvis, giving her shoulder a poke. Regan opened a bleary eye and tried to focus it on the alarm clock. I got loads of time. She harrumphed and pulled the duvet over her head. The work due the previous night had been dull, so she'd drunk more than she intended to. But I thought you were taking Cleo to the airport. Regan got out of bed so fast she forgot to put her feet down and instead tumbled to the floor face first. Jarvis guffawed. Ow, that bloody hurt! She jumped up and thrust her face up to the mirror. I've got a carpet burn on my nose. She gave it a rub and removed a piece of lettuce from her cheek. Remember, you're picking Cleo up from her studio and not the apartment. I know. Regan hadn't remembered this, but being reminded by Jarvis was a daily irritant. She began picking things up and flinging them in all directions. Regan, please don't leave the apartment in a state, said Jarvis, adjusting his tie. She was doing a passable impression of the Tasmanian devil as she tried to decide what she needed to do first. I hate coming home to a mess. He sighed deeply. Perhaps we need to have another discussion about this later, hmm? A bra sailed past his ear. Pants, said Regan decisively. Pants were always a good starting point. She began pulling underwear from her top drawer. No, actually, I need a wee first. And she dashed off to the bathroom, taking a clean pair of pants and yesterday's clothes with her in the hope she could get dressed whilst sitting on the loo to save some time. You really should allow more time, said Jarvis with a tut. Regan gave him a sarcastic smile and shut the bathroom door.
Rebecca Cooper narrating Meet Me at Pebble Beach, written by my guest, Bella Osborne. By the sound of it, you're very disciplined, so I should guess that you've already started on the next novel.
I have indeed. So book seven, I've got two books out this year, which is a first for me. And the second one is a Christmas book, which is also a first for me. And I'm in the final throes of editing that at the moment. So I'm just doing copy edits right now. Yes, that was written quite a while ago. I ended up writing this one before I wrote Meet Me at Pebble Beach. So that's sat on the back burner and then I've come back to it to edit it. So yes, that's almost ready and that'll be out in October.
Again as a serial?
No, because we've got two out this year, we hadn't got the time to put it out as a serial. So again, for the first time in a while, this is going to come out just as a whole book. But I did write it as a serial. So it's set over Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day and the 27th of December. So it was written in four parts because that was our assumption that it would go out in four parts. But then when we've come to look at it, because of the way the Christmas market is, we want to get it out. So it's with readers sort of October time, so it's there for the build-up to Christmas. If we'd put it out in parts, we'd have probably been releasing the first part in August, which is not that Christmassy. So it probably wasn't the right thing to do. So after discussion, that's what we decided to do, was we'd just put it out as one book in October, which makes more sense.
And can you share the title with us?
I can. Literally, in the last couple of days, it's been finalised, and it's going to be called One Family Christmas. So that's an exclusive there, Red.
Well, you've heard it first on RNIB Connect Radio. Bella Osborne, I hope you'll come back at Christmas to talk about the new book. But in the meantime, stay well and thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Red, and thanks to all your listeners.
Meet Me at Pebble Beach by Bella Osborne is TB705443. For more information about it and Bella's other novels, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Now, the last we heard from the Braille Library was that due to the current outbreak and the public health guidelines, the Braille Library has closed and suspension of all hard copy Braille was underway. But Ali Long, Head of Consumer Services at RNIB, is here with an update. Ali, what's happening now?
Good news. We're back up and running. So I think back when the government kind of started to ease things, we followed the advice and we've been quietly dispatching books since the 20th of May with social distancing and other measures in place in the library. And we've just about broken the back of the backlog. So we had an enormous amount of books. Although we asked customers not to send them back, they were kind of arriving at the sorting office, and they did call us at one point and say, "We've got no more space. please take some deliveries." So we did have to arrange some special deliveries, and the staff have been amazing, and they're pleased to be back, I should say. And we've got screens, and we've got these kind of floor markings that are just like if you go into Tesco's these days with the arrows. And all is going well. So, we are starting to contact customers again to say, we're open. And if they want to send their books back and choose more books, then call the helpline for help with any selections. And, we'll get those to people as quickly as possible. And I suppose the other really kind of great news on the back of, sadly, we didn't want to suspend the service, but, we did get in touch with quite a number of our Braille Library members to ask them if they would be able to use an Orbit Braille device, an electronic device. And we've had quite a significant uptake in that. So we've already sent out, I think, 150 orbits to library members, and I think we've still got about 70 applications that we're kind of working through. So that's great news, and we've managed to put about 700 books on the SD card that goes with the orbits. So quite a lot of reading material on there to keep people going, particularly if they're not comfortable with kind of connecting and downloading, you know, at this point in time, because, you know, some support's probably better face-to-face, and we can't do that just yet. So we're keeping, you know, quite a lot of people going with reading material in different ways.
So if someone's listening who has Braille books on loan, they should start to send them back?
Yes, yeah, we're happy to receive them.
And of course, with the Orbit Reader, if you are connected online, you can download e-textbooks, which then are converted into Braille.
Yes, you can. Yeah, there's a range of different ways that you can access books on those devices, including our own new online reading service. So we are gradually uploading the collection to the new platform, and that's kind of so the number of Braille books available is growing there. And, you know, we're starting work on adding EPUB to the same platform, which you would be able to download, you know, what we call a soft Braille or eBraille edition of as well. So there will be more and more ways to access digital Braille.
And of course, there's the whole lot of talking books available through reading services as well.
Yes. And that is growing, and you know, publishers have been fantastic with, you know, donating their commercial audio books to us, and we're recording some still as well to add to the collection. So, and the Talking Book Service has been operating, you know, throughout the pandemic, and that's it's been a little bit slower, but you know, the books have been coming back, and we've been getting them out. And again, we're looking at, over the next couple of weeks, speeding that up again, as you know, some of our offices are kind of opening and more staff available. So really, you know, that's been really fantastic, keeping people reading. And of course, you've been doing a great job on Connect Radio as well of broadcasting more books, which I know customers have enjoyed.
And if someone wants to find out more, where can they go?
So they can go to the web pages, the reading services web pages, and find out more, or, you know, they can call the helpline.
The helpline is 0303 123 9999. The web address is reading services, that's all one word, readingservices.rnib.org.uk. And as Ali says, there are two talking book shows running every weekday on RNIB Connect Radio. The first at 8 a.m, the second at 2 p.m, which is repeated at 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. And in addition, we have our weekend talking book for younger listeners. But once again, if you're interested in the RNIB library, the helpline is 0303 123 9999. And Ali Long, thank you so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Great, nice to be here.
Sir Salman Rushdie is a master storyteller. His first novel, Midnight's Children, won the 1981 Booker Prize. And he was shortlisted again last year for his latest novel, Key Shot, which is when I asked him for the books of his life.
Was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I think probably I would have to say it was Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which I read while growing up in India, and described to me a world that was doubly Wonderland-like. One was a world of England, and the other was the magic world that Lewis Carroll takes us into. And I did fall in love with it, and with its companion sequel, The Through Looking Glass. I fell in love with the drawings of Sir John Tenniel. I think people underestimate how beautifully written Alice in Wonderland is. And yeah, I think that was the first book that really sort of set my young reader mind alight.
Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank and of having nothing to do. Once or twice she had peeped into the book her sister was reading, but it had no pictures or conversations in it. And what is the use of a book, thought Alice, without pictures or conversation? So she was considering in her own mind, as well as she could, for the hot day made her feel very sleepy and stupid, whether the pleasure of making a daisy chain would be worth the trouble of getting up and picking the daisies, when suddenly a white rabbit with pink eyes ran close by her. There was nothing so very remarkable in that, nor did Alice think it so very much out of the way to hear the rabbit say to itself, oh dear, I shall be too late. When she thought it over afterwards, it occurred to her that she ought to have wondered at this, but at the time it all seemed quite natural. But when the rabbit actually took a watch out of its waistcoat pocket and looked at it, and then hurried on, Alice started to her feet, for it flashed across her mind that she'd never before seen a rabbit with either a waistcoat pocket or a watch to take out of it. And burning with curiosity, she ran across the field after it, and fortunately was just in time to see it pop down a large rabbit hole under the hedge. In another moment, down went Alice after it, never once considering how in the world she was to get out again.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB13087, which is narrated by Robin Holmes.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, my guilty pleasure for a very long time was The Lord of the Rings, which I discovered as a teenager and that fell into, not unlike Alice going down the rabbit hole. And I've returned to it several times. I find it an almost perfectly created imaginary world and very beautiful to visit from time to time.
Now, it is a curious fact that this is not the story as Bilbo first told it to his companions. To them, his account was that Gollum had promised to give him a present if he won the game. But when Gollum went to fetch it from the island, he found the treasure was gone, a magic ring which had been given to him long ago on his birthday. Bilbo guessed that this was the very ring that he had found, and as he had won the game, it was already his by right. But being in a tight place, he said nothing about it and made Gollum show him the way out as a reward instead of a present. This account Bilbo set down in his memoirs, and he seems never to have altered it himself, not even after the Council of Elrond. Evidently it still appeared in the original Red Book, as it did in several copies and abstracts. But many copies contain the true account as an alternative, derived, no doubt, from notes by Frodo or Samwise, both of whom learned the truth, though they seem to have been unwilling to delete anything actually written by the old hobbit himself. Gandalf, however, disbelieved Bilbo's first story as soon as he heard it, and he continued to be very curious about the ring. Eventually he got the true tale out of Bilbo after much questioning, which for a while strained their friendship. But the wizard seemed to think the truth important.
David Banks narrating The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, there's a novel I ended up reviewing for the New York Times, which is written by a young African writer, Namwale Serpell, a novel called The Old Drift, which is a novel about the rise of independent Zambia, if you like, but that's putting it too boldly. It's about a number of characters, very powerful women characters, who we follow through several decades of Zambian history. Part of it is realist, part of it is magic realist, part of it is what is now called Afrofuturist. And Namwale Serpell is one of a generation of African women writers who are really changing the story of African literature. And I admired the book very much.
At first, they didn't know. It was disguised by the motley silt of the womb, those red strands marbling the white scud of the vernix, and they were distracted by the baby's cries and the task of severing the twisty blue link to its mother. The midwives passed the baby to its grandmother, whose name was Giovanna. She held it, noted that it was female, and used her pinky to swipe a cross into its grimy forehead. Only then did Giovanna peer closer. What's this? Hair? Long, dark, sticky swirls of hair all over the stippled skin of her first and only granddaughter. The midwives were still circling the mother's shipwrecked body, tending to her, murmuring like the sea, the child's cries like that same sea breaking. Giovanna swaddled the baby in elaborate folds and handed the burden to its bearer. The mother, whose name was Adriana, looked down at the hairy little face and promptly fainted. Giovanna grabbed the baby just before it tumbled off the bed. The midwives laughed. Such drama. The wool would fall out. The whelp had just forgotten to eat it in the womb. Adriana woke to firm entreaties that she breastfeed. She took the baby into her arms. The hair seemed to have already grown longer and darker.
The Old Drift by Namwali Sirpel is available commercially, including as an audiobook narrated by Adjua Ando, Richard E. Grant, and Cobner Holdbrook-Smith.
So Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you. It's been really a pleasure.
A wide selection of novels by Sir Salman Rushdie is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And don't forget, you can hear the whole interview by downloading the Read On podcast from your favourite provider. If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well, and don't forget to read on.